nodded, then stared down at his hands for a few seconds. "Carlo, Galdo," he said, "will you sit the steps tomorrow so I can think about this?" "Yes," they said without hesitation, and Father Chains didn't miss the note of hope in their voices. He would remember that moment ever after, the night the Sansas conceded that Locke would be the brains of their operation, the night they were relieved to have him as the brains of their operation. "Honestly dead," said Locke, "and not killed by us, and not even stiff yet. Right. I know we can do it. It'll be easy. I just don't know why or how yet."
"Your confidence heartens me," said Chains. "But I want you to remember that you're on a very short leash. If a tavern should happen to burn down or a riot should happen to break out around you, I'll throw you off this roof with lead ingots tied around your neck."
Carlo and Galdo stared at Locke once again.
"Short leash, right. But don't worry," said Locke. "I'm not as reckless as I was. You know, when I was little."
2. The next day Locke walked the length of the temple district on his own for the very first time, hooded in a clean white robe of Perelandro's order with silvery embroidery on the sleeves, waist high to virtually everyone around him. He was astonished at the courtesy given to the robe, a courtesy he clearly understood that in many cases only partially devolved on the poor fool wearing the robe. Most Camori regarded the Order of Perelandro with a mixture of cynicism and guilty pity. The unabashed charity of the god and his priesthood just didn't speak to the rough heart of the city's character. Yet the reputation of Father Chains as a colourful freak of piety paid certain dividends. Men who surely joked about the simpering of the beggar god's white-robed priests with their friends nonetheless threw coins into Chains' kettle, eyes averted when they passed his temple. It turned out they also let a little robed initiate pass on the street without harassment. Groups parted fluidly and merchants nodded almost politely as Locke went on his way. For the first time he learned what a powerful thrill it was to go about in public in an effective disguise. The sun was creeping upward toward noon. The crowds were thick and the city was alive with the echoes and murmurs of its masses. Locke padded intently to the southwest corner of the temple district, where a glass cat bridge arched across the canal to the island of the old citadel. Cat bridges were another legacy of the Eldrin who'd ruled before the coming of men. Narrow glass arches no wider than an ordinary man's hips, arranged in pairs over most of Camor's canals and at several places along the Angevin River. Although they looked smooth, their glimmering surfaces were as rough as shark's hide leather. For those with a reasonable measure of agility and confidence, they provided the only convenient means of crossing water at many points. Traffic was always one-directional over each cat bridge. Ducal decree clearly stated that anyone going the wrong direction could be shoved off by those with the right of way. As he scuttled across this bridge, pondering furiously, Locke recalled some of the history lessons Chains had drilled into him. The old citadel district had once been the home of the Dukes of Camor, centuries earlier, when all the city-states claimed by the Therin people had knelt to a single throne in the imperial city of Therim Pell. That line of Camori nobility, in superstitious dread of the perfectly good glass towers left behind by the Eldrin, had erected a massive stone palace in the heart of southern Camor. When one of Nicovante's great-great predecessors, on finer points of city law such as this, Locke's undeniably prodigious knowledge dissolved in a haze of total indifference, took up residence in the silver-glass tower called Raven's Reach, the old family fortress had become the Palace of Patience, the heart of Camor's municipal justice such as it was. The Yellow Jackets and their officers were headquartered there, as were the Duke's magistrates, 12 men and women who presided over their cases in scarlet robes and velvet masks, their true identities never to be revealed to the general public. Each was named for one of the months of the year, Justice Parthis, Justice Festal, Justice Aurim, and so forth, though each one passed judgment year-round. And there were dungeons, and there were the gallows on the black bridge that led to the palace gates, and there were other things. While the secret peace had greatly reduced the number of people who took the short, sharp drop off the Black Bridge, and didn't Duke Nicovante love to publicly pin that on his own magnanimity, the Duke's servants had devised other punishments that were spectacular in their cruel cleverness, if technically non-lethal. The palace was a great square heap of pitted black and grey stone, 10 stories high. The huge bricks that formed its walls had been arranged into simple mosaics that had now weathered to a ghostly state. The rows of high-arched windows that decorated every other level of the tower were stained glass, with black and red designs predominating. At night a light would burn ominously behind each one, dim red eyes in the darkness, staring out in all directions. Those windows were never dark. The intended message was clear. There were 4 open-topped circular towers jutting out from each corner of the palace, seemingly hanging in air from the 6th or 7th level up. On the sides of these hung black iron crow cages, in which prisoners singled out for special mistreatment would be aired out for a few hours or even a few days, with their feet dangling. Yet even these were seats in paradise compared to the spider cages, a spectacle that became visible to Locke between the backs and shoulders of adults as he stepped off the catbridge and into the crowds of the old citadel. From the southeastern tower of the Palace of Patience were dangled 6 cages on long steel chains, swaying gently in the wind like little spiders on cords of silk. 2 of these were moving, one slowly headed up and the other rapidly descending. Prisoners condemned to the spider cages were not to be allowed a moment's peace, so other prisoners condemned to hard labour would toil at the huge capstans atop the tower, working in shifts around the clock until a subject in a cage was deemed to be sufficiently unhinged and contrite. Lurching and creaking and open to the elements on all sides, the cages would go up and down ceaselessly. At night one could frequently hear the occupants pleading and screaming, even from a district or two away. The old citadel wasn't a very cosmopolitan district. Outside the Palace of Patience there were canal docks and stables reserved for the Yellow Jackets, offices for the Duke's tax collectors and scribes and other functionaries, and seedy little coffee houses where freelance solicitors and law scribes would try to drum up work from the families and friends of those being held in the palace. A few pawn shops and other businesses clung tenaciously to the northern part of the island, but for the most part they were crowded out by the grimmer business of the Duke's government. The district's other major landmark was the Black Bridge that spanned the wide canal between Old Citadel and the Mara Camorrazza. A tall arch of black human-set stone adorned with red lamps that were fixed up with ceremonial black shrouds that could be lowered with a few tugs on a rope. The hangings were conducted from a wooden platform that jutted off the bridge's south side. Supposedly, the unquiet shades of the condemned would be carried out to sea if they died over running water. Some thought that they would then be incarnated in the bodies of sharks, which explained why Camor Bay had such a problem with the creatures, and the idea was not entirely scoffed at. As far as most Camori were concerned, turnabout was fair play. Locke stared at the Black Bridge for a good long while, exercising that capacity for conniving that Chains had so forcefully repressed for many long months. He was far too young for much self-analysis, but the process of scheming gave him real pleasure, like a little ball of tingling warmth in the pit of his stomach. He had no name for what he was doing, but in the collision of his whirling thoughts a plan began to form, and the more he thought on it, the more pleased he became with himself. It was a fine thing that his white hood concealed his face from most passers-by, lest anyone should see an initiate of Perelandro staring fixedly at a gallows and grinning wildly. 3. "I need the names of any men who are going to hang in the next week or two," said Locke, as he and Chains set the temple steps the next day. "If you were enterprising," said Chains, "and you most certainly are, you could get them yourself and leave your poor fat old master in peace."
"I would, but I need someone else to do it. It won't work if I'm seen around the Palace of Patience before the hangings."
"What won't work?"
"The plan."
Oh-ho! Nervy little Shades Hill purse-clutcher, thinking you can keep me in the dark. What plan?
The plan to steal a corpse.
Ahem. Anything else you'd like to tell me about it?
It's brilliant.
A passerby tossed something into the kettle. Locke bowed and Chains waved his hands in the man's general direction, his restraints clattering, and yelled,
50 years of health to you and your children, and the blessings of the Lord of the Overlooked!
It would have been 100 years, muttered Chains when the man had passed, but that sounded like a clipped half-copper.
Now, your brilliant plan. I know you've had audacious plans, but I'm not entirely sure you've had a brilliant one yet.
This is the one, then. Honest, but I need those names.
If it's so, it's so.
Chains leaned backward and stretched, grunting in satisfaction as his back creaked and popped.
I'll get them for you tonight.
And I'll need some money.
Ah, well, I expected that. Take what you need from the vault and mark it on the ledger. Screw around with it, though.
I know. Lead ingots. Screaming. Death.
Something like that.
You're a little on the small side, but I suppose Jessalyn might learn a thing or two from your corpse anyway. 4. Penance Day was the traditional day for hangings in Camor. Each week a sullen handful of prisoners would be trotted out from the Palace of Patience, priests and guards surrounding them. Noon was the hour of the drop. At the 8th hour of the morning, when the functionaries in the courtyard of the palace threw open their wooden shutters and settled in for a long day of saying, "Fuck off in the name of the Duke," to all comers, 3 robed initiates of Perelandro wheeled a narrow wooden pull-cart into the courtyard. The smallest of the 3 made his way over to the first available clerk. His thin little face barely topped the forward edge of the clerk's booth.
"Well, this is odd," said the clerk,
a woman of late middle years, shaped something like a bag of potatoes, but perhaps not quite as warm or sympathetic.
"Help you with something?" "There's a man being hanged," said Locke. "Noon today." "You don't say. Here I thought it was a state secret." "His name's Antrim. Antrim One Hand, they call him. He's got..."
"One hand?"
"Yes, he drops today. Fire setting, theft, dealing with slavers. Charming man." "I was going to say that he had a wife," said Locke. "She has business about him." "Look, the time for appeals is past. Saris, Festal, and Tathris sealed the death warrant. Antrim One Hand belongs to Morgante now, and then to Azaguia. Not even one of the beggar god's cute little sprats can help him at this point."
"I know," said Locke. "I don't want him spared. His wife doesn't care if he gets hanged. I'm here about the body."
"Really?"
Genuine curiosity flickered in the clerk's eyes for the first time.
"Now that is odd. What about the body?" "His wife knows he deserves to get hanged, but she wants him to get a fairer chance. You know, with the Lady of the Long Silence. So she's paid for us to take the body and put it in our temple, so we can burn candles and pray for intercession in Perelandro's name for 3 days and nights. We'll bury him after that."
"Well, no," said the clerk. "The corpses usually get cut down after an hour and tossed into holes on the beggar's barrow. More than they deserve, but it's tidy. We don't usually just go handing them out to anyone who wants one."
"I know. My master cannot see or leave our temple, or else he'd be here to explain himself. But where all he has? I'm supposed to say that he knows this is making trouble for you."
Locke's little hand appeared over the edge of the booth, and when it withdrew, a small leather purse was sitting on the clerk's counting board.
"That's very considerate of him. We all know how devoted old Father Chains is."
The clerk swept the purse behind her counter and gave it a shake. It jingled, and she grunted.
"Still a bit of a problem, though. My master would be grateful for any help you could give us.
Another purse appeared on the counter, and the clerk actually broke a smile.
"It's within the realm of possibility," she said. "Not quite certain yet, of course."
Locke conjured a third purse, and the clerk nodded.
"I'll speak to the masters of the ropes, little one." "We even brought our own cart," said Locke. "We don't want to be any trouble." "I'm sure you won't be."
Her demeanour softened for just a moment.
"I didn't mean ill by what I said about the beggar god boy." "I didn't take it ill, madam. After all, it's what we do."
He favoured her with what he thought was his most endearing little grin.
"Did you not give me what I asked for, because I begged, simply out of the goodness of your own heart, with no coin involved?" "Why, of course I did."
She actually winked at him.
20 years of health to you and your children,"
Locke said, bowing and briefly disappearing beneath the lip of her counter.
"And the blessings of the Lord of the Overlooked."
5. It was a short, neat hanging. The Duke's masters of the ropes were nothing if not well practised at their trade. It wasn't the first execution Locke had ever seen, nor would it be the last. He and the Sansa brothers even had a chance to make all the proper reverential gestures when one of the condemned begged for Perelandro's blessings at the last minute. Traffic across the Black Bridge was halted for executions. A small crowd of guards, spectators, and priests milled about afterward as the requisite hour passed. The corpses twisted in the breeze beneath them, ropes creaking. Locke and the Sansas stood off to the side respectfully with their little cart. Eventually, yellow jackets began to haul the bodies up one by one under the watchful eyes of several priests of Azaguia. The corpses were carefully set down in an open dray pulled by 2 black horses draped in the black and silver of the Death Goddess Order. The last corpse to be drawn up was that of a wiry man with a long beard and a shaved head. His left hand ended in a puckered red stump. 4 yellow jackets carried this body over to the cart where the boys waited. A priestess of Azaguia accompanied them. Locke felt a chill run up and down his spine when that inscrutable silver mesh mask tilted down toward him.
"Little brothers of Perelandro," said the priestess, "what intercession would you plead for on behalf of this man?"
Her voice was that of a very young woman, perhaps no more than 15 or 16. If anything, that only enhanced her eeriness in Locke's eyes, and he found his throat suddenly dry.
"We plead for whatever will be given," said Carlo. "The will of the 12 is not ours to presume," continued Galdo.
The priestess inclined her head very slightly. "I'm told this man's widow requested an interment in the house of Perelandro before burial."
"Apparently she thought he might need it, begging pardon," said Carlo.
"It's not without precedent, but it is far more usual for the aggrieved to seek our intercession with the lady."
"Our master," managed Locke, "made a solemn promise to the poor woman that we would give our care. Surely we mean no ill toward you or the lady most fair, if we must keep our word."
"Of course, I did not mean to suggest that you had done anything wrong. The lady will weigh him in the end, whatever is said and done before the vessel is entombed."
She gestured, and the yellow jacket set the corpse down on the cart. One of them unfurled a cheap cotton shroud and swung it over Antrim's body, leaving only the top of his head uncovered.
"Blessings of the Lady of the Long Silence to you and your master."
"Blessings of the Lord of the Overlooked,"
said Locke, as he and the Sansas bowed in unison from the waist. A braided silver cord around the priestess' neck marked her as more than a simple initiate like themselves.
"To you and your brothers and sisters."
The Sansa brothers each took 1 pole at the front of the cart, and Locke took up the rear, to push and to keep the load balanced. He was instantly sorry that he'd taken this spot. The hanging had filled the man's breeches with his own shit, and the smell was rising. Gritting his teeth, he called out,
"To the house of Perelandro, with all dignity!"
Plodding slowly, the Sansas pulled the cart down the western side of the Black Bridge, and then turned north to head for the wide, low bridge that led to the shifting markets' eastern district. It was a slightly roundabout way home, but not at all suspicious, at least until the three white-robed boys were well away from anyone who'd seen them leave the hanging. Moving with a bit more haste and enjoying the added deference the dead man was bringing them, save only for Locke, who was still effectively downwind of the poor fellow's last futile act in life, they turned left and headed for the bridges to the Fauna. Once there, they pressed south and crossed into the Videnza district, a relatively clean and spacious island well patrolled by yellow jackets. At the heart of the Videnza was a market square of merchant artisans, recognized names who disdained the churning chaos of the shifting market. They operated from the first floors of their fine old sagging houses, which were always freshly mortared and whitewashed over their post and timber frames. The district's tiled roofs, by tradition, were glazed in brightly irregular colors, blue and purple and red and green. They teased the eyes and gleamed like glass under the glare of the sun. At the northern entrance to the square, Carlo darted away from the cart and vanished into the crowd. Locke came up from the rear, muttering prayers of gratitude to take his place. So arrayed, they hauled their odd cargo toward the shop of Ambrosine Strollo, first lady of Camor's chandlers, furnisher to the Duke himself. "If there's a niggardly speck of genuine fellowship in Camor," Chains had once said, "one little place where Perelandro's name isn't spoken with a sort of sorry contempt, it's the Videnza. Merchants are a miserly lot, and craftsfolk are pressed with care. However, those that turn a very pretty profit plying their chosen trade are likely to be somewhat happy. They get the best of all worlds for common folk, assuming our lot doesn't fuck with them." Locke was impressed with the response he and Galdo received as they drew the cart up in front of Madame Strollo's four-story home. Here the merchants and customers alike bowed their heads as the corpse passed. Many of them even made the wordless gesture of benediction in the name of the 12, touching first their eyes with both hands, and then their lips, and finally their hearts. "My dears," said Madame Strollo, "what an honour, and what an unusual errand you must be on." She was a slender woman getting well on in years, a sort of cosmic opposite to the clerk Locke had dealt with that morning. Strollo exuded attentive deference. She behaved as though the two little red-faced initiates, sweating heavily under their robes, were full priests of a more powerful order. If she could smell the mess in Antrim's breeches, she refrained from saying so. She sat at the street-side window of her shop, under a heavy wooden awning that folded down at night to seal the place tight against mischief. The window was perhaps 10 feet wide and half as high, and Madame Strollo was surrounded by candles, stacked layer upon layer, tier upon tier, like the houses and towers of a fantastical wax city. Alchemical globes had largely replaced the cheap taper as the light source of choice for nobility and lobility alike. The few remaining master chandlers fought back by mingling ever more lovely scents in their creations. Additionally, there was the ceremonial need of Camor's temples and believers, a need that cold glass light was generally considered inadequate to meet.
"We're interring this man," said Locke, "for 3 days and nights before his burial. My master needs new candles for the ceremony."
"Old Chains, you mean? Poor dear man. Let's see. You'll want lavender for cleanliness, and autumn blood flower for the blessing, and sulphur roses for the lady most fair?"
"Please," said Locke, pulling out a humble leather purse that jingled with silver. "And some votives without scent, half a dozen of all four kinds."
Madame Strollo carefully selected the candles and wrapped them in waxed burlap.
"A gift of the house," she muttered when Locke began to open his mouth, "and perhaps I put a few more than half a dozen of each in the packet."
Locke tried to argue with her for form's sake, but the old woman grew conveniently deaf for a few crucial seconds as she finished wrapping her goods. Locke paid 3 solons out of his purse, taking care to let her see that there were a dozen more nestled therein, and wished Madame Strollo a full 100 years of health for herself and her children in the name of the Lord of the Overlooked as he backed away. He set the package of candles on the cart, tucking it just under the blanket beside Antrim's glassy, staring eyes. No sooner had he turned around to resume his place next to Galdo when a taller boy, dressed in ragged, dirty clothes, walked right into him, sending him tumbling onto his back.
"Oh!" said the boy, who happened to be Carlo Sanza. "A thousand pardons! I'm so clumsy! Here, let me help you up!"
He grabbed Locke's outstretched hand and yanked the smaller boy back to his feet.
12 gods! An initiate! Forgive me, forgive me! I simply did not see you standing there!"
Clucking with concern, he brushed dirt from Locke's white robe.
"Are you well?" "I am, I am. Forgive my clumsiness. I meant no insult." "None is taken. Thank you for helping me back up."
With that, Carlo gave a mock bow and ran off into the crowd. In just a few seconds, he was lost to sight. Locke made a show of dusting himself off while he slowly counted to 30 inside his head. At 31, he sat down suddenly beside the cart, put his hooded head in his hands, and began to sniffle. Just a few seconds later, he was sobbing loudly. Responding to the cue, Galdo came over and knelt beside him, placing one hand on his shoulder.
"Boys," said Ambrosine Strollo, "boys, what's the matter? Are you hurt? Did that oaf jar something?"
Galdo made a show of muttering into Locke's ear. Locke muttered back, and Galdo fell backward onto his own posterior. He reached up and tugged at his hood in an excellent imitation of frustration, and his eyes were wide.
"No, Madam Strollo," he said. "It's worse than that."
"Worse? What do you mean? What's the trouble?"
"It's silver,"
Locke burbled, looking up to let her see the tears pouring down his cheeks and the artful curl of his lips.
"He took my purse, picked my pocket." "It was payment," said Galdo, "from this man's widow, not just for the candles, but for his interment, our blessings and his funeral. We were to bring it back to Father Chains along with the..."
"With the body,"
Locke burst out.
"I failed him."
12, the old lady muttered. "That incredible little bastard."
Leaning out over the counter of her shop window, she hollered in a voice of surprising strength,
"Thief! Stop, thief!"
As Locke buried his head in his hands once again, she turned her head upward and shouted,
"Lucrezia!"
"Yes, Grandmama," came a voice from an open window. "What's this about a thief?"
"Rouse your brothers, child. Get them down here now and tell them to bring their sticks."
She turned to regard Locke and Galdo.
"Don't cry, my dear boys, don't cry. We'll make this right somehow." "What's this about a thief?"
A lanky sergeant of the watch ran up, truncheon out, mustard yellow coat flapping behind him, and two other yellow jackets at his heels.
"A fine constable you are, Vidric, to let those little coat-charmer bastards from the cauldron sneak in and rob customers right in front of my shop." "What, here? Them?"
The watch sergeant took in the distraught boys, the furious old woman, and the covered corpse. His eyebrows attempted to leap straight up off his forehead.
"And that... I say, that man is dead." "Of course he's dead, thimble brains. These boys are taking him to the house of Perelandro for blessings and a funeral. That little cutpurse just stole the bag with his widow's payment for it all." "Someone robbed the initiates of Perelandro? The boys who helped that blind priest?"
A florid man with an overachieving belly and an entire squad of spare chins wobbled up, with a walking stick in one hand and a wicked-looking hatchet in the other.
"Pissant rat-fucker bastards! Such an infamy! In the Videnza, in broad light of day!"
"I'm sorry," Locke sobbed. "I'm so sorry, I didn't realize. I should have held it tighter. He was so quick."
"Nonsense, boy, it was hardly your fault," said Madame Strollo.
The watch sergeant began blowing his whistle, The fat man with the walking stick continued to spit vitriol, and a pair of young men appeared around the corner of the Strollo house, carrying curved truncheons shod with brass. There was more rapid shouting until they determined that their grandmother was unhurt. When they discovered the reason for her summons, they too began uttering threats and curses and promises of vengeance.
"Here," said Madame Strollo, "here, boys, the candles will be my gift. This sort of thing doesn't happen in the Videnza. We won't stand for it."
She set the three solons Locke had given her back atop her counter.
"How much was in the purse?"
15 solons before we paid you," said Galdo. "So 12 got stolen. Chains is going to throw us out of the order."
"Don't be foolish," said Madame Strollo.
She added 2 more coins to the pile as the crowd around her shop began to swell.
"Hells yes," cried the fat man. "We can't let that little devil dishonor us like this. Madame Strollo, how much are you giving? I'll give more." "Gods take you, you selfish old pig. This isn't about showing me up."
"I'll give you a basket of oranges," said one of the women in the crowd, "for you and for the eyeless priest."
"I have a solon I can give," said
another merchant, pressing forward with the coin in his hand.
"Vidric!"
Madame Strollo turned from her argument with her florid neighbour.
"Vidric, this is your fault. You owe these initiates some copper at the very least."
"My fault? Now look here."
"No, you look here. When they speak of the Videnza now, they'll say, 'Ah, that's where they rob priests, isn't it? For the 12's sake, just like Catchfire, or worse.'"
She spat.
"You give something to make amends, or I'll harp on your captain, and you'll end up rowing a shitboat until your hair turns grey and your teeth come out at the roots."
Grimacing, the watch sergeant stepped forward and reached for his purse, but there was already a tight press around the two boys. They were helped to their feet, and Locke received too many comforting pats on the back to count. They were plied with coins, fruit, and small gifts. One merchant tossed his more valuable coins into a coat pocket and handed over his purse. Locke and Galdo adopted convincing expressions of bewilderment and surprise. As each gift was handed over to them, they protested as best they could, for form's sake. 6. It was the 4th hour of the afternoon before the body of Antrim One Hand was safely stashed in the damp sanctuary of the House of Perelandro. The 3 white-robed boys, for Carlo had rejoined them safely at the edge of the temple district, padded down the steps and took their seats beside Father Chains, who sat in his usual spot with one burly arm thrown over the rim of his copper kettle.
"So," he said, "boys, is Jessalyn going to be sorry she saved my life?"
"Not at all," said Locke. "It's a great corpse," said Carlo. "Smells a bit," said Galdo. "Other than that," said Carlo, "it's a fantastic corpse." "Hanged at noon," said Locke. "Still fresh."
"I'm very pleased. Very, very pleased. But I really must ask, why the hell have men and women been throwing money in my kettle for the past half hour, telling me they're sorry for what happened in the Videnza?"
"It's because they're sorry for what happened in the Videnza," said Galdo. "It wasn't a burning tavern, benefactor's own truth," said Locke.
"What," said Chains, speaking slowly as though to a misbehaving pet,
"did you boys do with the corpse before you stashed it in the temple?"
"Made money."
Locke tossed the merchant's donated purse into the kettle, where it hit with a heavy clang.
23 solons 3, to be precise." "And a basket of oranges," said Carlo. "Plus a packet of candles," added Galdo. 2 loaves of black pepper bread, a wax carton of small beer, and some glow globes."
Chains was silent for a moment, and then he actually peeked down into the kettle, pretending to readjust his blindfold by raising it just a bit at the bottom. Carlo and Galdo began to confide the roughest outline of the scheme Locke had prepared and executed with their help, giggling as they did so.
"Bugger me bloody with a boat hook," Chains said when they finished. "I don't recall telling you that your leash was slipped enough for fucking street theatre, Locke."
"We had to get our money back somehow," said Locke. "Cost us 15 silvers to get the body from the Palace of Patience. Now we're up some, plus candles and bread and beer."
"Oranges," said Carlo. "Glow globes," said Galdo. "Don't forget those. They're pretty."
"Crooked Warden," said Chains. "Just this morning I was suffering from the delusion that I was handing out the educations here."
They sat in companionable silence for a few moments after that, while the sun settled into its downward arc in the west, and long shadows began to creep across the face of the city.
"Well, what the hell?"
Chains rattled his manacles a few times to keep up his circulation.
"I'll take back what I gave you to spend. Of the extra, Carlo, you and Galdo can have a silver apiece to do as you please. Locke, you can have the rest to put toward your dues. It was fairly stolen."
At that moment, a well-dressed man in a forest green coat and a four-cornered hat walked up to the temple steps. He threw a handful of coins into the kettle. They sounded like mingled silver and copper as they clattered. The man tipped his hat to the three boys and said,
"I'm from the Videnza. I want you to know that I'm furious about what happened."
100 years of health for you and your children," said Locke, "and the blessings of the Lord of the Overlooked."
Chapter 5 The Grey King 1
"You seem to be spending a great deal of our money very quickly, Lucas," said Doña Sofia Salvara.
"Circumstance has blessed us, Doña Sofia."
Locke gave a smile that was a measure of great triumph by Fairwhite standards, a tight-lipped little thing that might have been a grimace of pain from anyone else.
"Everything is proceeding with the most agreeable speed. Ships and men and cargo, and soon all we'll need to do is pack your wardrobe for a short voyage."
"Indeed, indeed."
Were those dark circles under her eyes? Was there the slightest hint of wariness in her attitude toward him? She certainly wasn't at ease. Locke made a mental note to avoid pushing her too far, too fast. It was a delicate dance, playing straight lines and smiles with someone who knew he was a mummer but didn't know that he knew she knew. With the slightest sigh, Doña Sofia pressed her personal sigil down into the warm blue wax at the bottom of the parchment she was contemplating. She added a few flowing lines of ink above the seal, her signature in the curving Therin script that had become something of a fad among literate nobles in the past few years.
"If you say you require another 4,000 today, another 4,000 it must be."
"I am most sincerely grateful, my lady."
"Well, you'll certainly pay for it soon enough," she said. "Many times over, if our hopes play out."
At that she smiled, with genuine good humour that crinkled the edges of her eyes, and held out the fresh promissory note. "Oho," thought Locke, "much better. The more in control the mark thinks they are, the more easily they respond to real control." Another one of Father Chain's old maxims, proven in Locke's experience too many times to count.
"Please give my warmest regards to your husband when he returns from his business in the city, my lady," said Locke, taking the wax-sealed parchment in hand. "Now, I fear, I must go see some men about payments that will not appear on any official ledger."
"Of course, I quite understand. Conte can show you out."
The gruff, weathered man-at-arms was paler than usual, and it seemed to Locke that there was a slight but obvious hitch in his stride. Yes, the poor fellow was clearly favouring a certain badly bruised portion of his anatomy. Locke's stomach turned in unconscious sympathy at his own memory of that night.
"I say, Conte," he began politely, "are you feeling quite well? You seem, forgive me for saying so, troubled this past day or two."
"I'm well for the most part, Master Fairwhite."
There was a slight hardening of the lines at the edges of the man's mouth. "Perhaps a bit under the weather."
"Nothing serious?"
"A minor ague, perhaps. They happen this time of year."
"Ah, one of the tricks of your climate. I've not yet felt such a thing myself."
"Well," said Conte, with an absolute lack of expression on his face, "mind yourself then, Master Fairwhite. Camor can be a very dangerous place in the most unlooked-for ways."
Oh, ho, ho, Locke thought. So they'd let him in on the secret as well.
And the man had a proud streak, at least as wide as Sophia's, to drop even the slightest hint of a threat. Worth noting that.
"I'm the very soul of caution, my dear Conte."
Locke tucked the promissory note within his black waistcoat and adjusted his cascading cravats as they approached the front door of the Salvara Manor.
"I keep my chambers very well illuminated to ward off miasmas, and I wear copper rings after false light. Just the thing for your hot and cold fevers. I would wager that a few days at sea will put you right."
"No doubt," said Conte. "The voyage. I do look forward to the voyage."
"Then we are of one mind."
Locke waited for the Don's man to open the wide glass and iron door for him, and as he stepped out into the moist air of false light, he nodded stiffly but affably.
"I shall pray for your health tomorrow, my good fellow."
"Too kind, Master Fairwhite." The ex-soldier had set one hand on the hilt of one of his knives, perhaps unconsciously. "I shall most assuredly offer prayers concerning yours."
Locke began walking south at a leisurely pace, crossing from the Isla Durona to Two Silver Green, as he and Carlo had just a few nights previously. The hangman's wind was stronger than usual, and as he walked through the park in the washed-out light of the city's glowing elderglass, the hiss and rustle of leaves was like the sighing of vast creatures hiding in the greenery all around him. Just under 17,000 crowns in half a week. The Don Salvara game was well ahead of their original plans, which had called for a 2-week span between first touch and final blow-off. Locke was certain he could get one more touch out of the Don in perfect safety, push the total up over 22 or maybe 23,000, and then pull a vanish. Go to ground, take it easy for a few weeks, stay alert and let the Grey King mess sort itself out. And then, as a bonus miracle, somehow convince Kappa Barsavi to disengage him from Nazca, and do so without twisting the old man's breeches. Locke sighed. When false light died and true night fell, the glow never seemed to simply fade so much as recede, as though it were being drawn back within the glass, alone reclaimed by a jealous creditor. Shadows widened and blackened until finally the whole park was swallowed by them from below. Emerald lanterns flickered to life here and there in the trees, their light soft and eerie and strangely relaxing. They offered just enough illumination to see the crushed stone paths that wound their way through the walls of trees and hedges. Locke felt as though the spring of tension within him was unwinding itself ever so slightly. He listened to the muted crunch of his own footsteps on gravel, and for a few moments he was surprised to find himself possessed by something perilously close to contentment. He was alive. He was rich. He had made the decision not to skulk and cringe from the troubles that gnawed at his gentleman bastards. And for one brief moment, in the middle of 88,000 people and all the heaving, stinking, ever-flowing noise and commerce and machinery of their city, he was alone with the gently swaying trees of Two Silver Green. Alone. The hairs on the back of his neck stood up, and the old cold fear, the constant companion of anyone raised on the streets, was suddenly alive within him. It was a summer night in Two Silver Green, the safest open park in the city, patrolled at any given time by 2 or 3 squads of yellow jackets, with their night lanterns waving on poles. filled, sometimes to the point of comedy, with the strolling sons and daughters of the wealthy classes, holding hands and swatting insects and seeking the privacy of nooks and shadows. Locke gazed quickly up and down the curving paths around him. He was truly alone. There was no sound in the park but for the sighing of the leaves and the buzzing of the insects. No voices or footsteps that he could hear. He twisted his right forearm, and a thin stiletto of blackened steel fell from his coat sleeve into his palm, pommel down. He carried it straight against his arm, rendering it invisible from any distance, and hurried toward the southern gate of the park. A mist was rising, seeping up as though the grass were pouring grey vapours into the night. Locke shivered despite the warm, heavy air. A mist was perfectly natural, wasn't it? The whole city was blanketed in the stuff 2 nights out of 3. A man could lose track of the end of his own nose in it sometimes, but why? The southern gate of the park. He was standing before the southern gate of the park, staring out across an empty cobbled lane at a mist-shrouded bridge. That bridge was the Eldrin Arch, its red lanterns soft and ominous in the fog. The Eldrin Arch leading north to the Isla Durona. He'd gotten turned around. How was that possible? His heart was beating so fast, and then Doña Sofia. That cunning, cunning bitch. She'd done something to him. Slipped him some alchemical mischief on the parchment. The ink? The wax? Was it a poison, drawing some cloud around his senses before it did its work? Was it some other drug, intended to make him ill? Petty, perfectly deniable revenge to sate her for the time being? He fumbled for the parchment, missing his inner coat pocket, aware that he was moving a bit too slowly and clumsily for the confusion to be entirely in his imagination. There were men moving under the trees. One to his left, another to his right. The Eldrin Arch was gone. He was back at the heart of the curving paths, staring out into a darkness cut only by the emerald light of the lanterns. He gasped, crouched, brought up the stiletto, head swimming. The men were cloaked. They were on either side. There was the sound of footsteps on gravel, not his own. The dark shape of crossbows, the backlit shapes of the men. His head whirled.
"Master Thorn," said a man's voice, muffled and distant. "We require an hour of your attention."
"Crooked Warden!"
Locke gasped, and then even the faint colours of the trees seemed to drain from his vision, and the whole night went black. 3. When he came to, he was already sitting up. It was a curious sensation. He'd awoken before from blackness brought on by injuries and by drugs, but this was different. It was as though someone had simply set the mechanisms of his consciousness moving again, like a scholar opening the spigot on a Ferrari water clock. He was in the common room of a tavern, seated on a chair at a table by himself. He could see the bar and the hearth and the other tables, but the place was dank and empty, smelling of mould and dust. A flickering orange light came from behind him, an oil lantern. The windows were greasy and misted over, turning the light back upon itself. He couldn't see anything of the outside through them.
"There's a crossbow at your back," said a voice just a few feet behind him,
a pleasantly cultured man's voice, definitely Komori, but somewhat off in a few of the pronunciations. A native who'd spent time elsewhere? The voice was entirely unknown to him.
"Master Thorn."
Icicles seemed to grow in Locke's spine. He racked his brains furiously for recall of those last few seconds in the park. Hadn't one of the men there called him that as well? He gulped.
"Why do you call me that? My name is Lucas Fairwhite. I'm a citizen of Emberlane, working for the House of Bel-Oster." "I could believe that, Master Thorn. Your accent is convincing, and your willingness to suffer that black wool is nothing short of heroic. Don Lorenzo and Doña Sofia certainly believed in Lucas Fairwhite, until you yourself disabuse them of the notion.
It isn't Barsavi, Locke thought desperately. It couldn't be Barsavi. Barsavi would be conducting this conversation himself, if he knew. He would be conducting it at the heart of the floating grave, with every gentleman bastard tied to a post and every knife in Sage Kindness' bag sharpened and gleaming.
"My name is Lucas Fairwhite," Locke insisted. "I don't understand what you want or what I'm doing here. Have you done anything to Grauman? Is he safe?"
"Jean Tannen is perfectly safe," said the man, "as you well know. How I would have loved to see it up close, when you strolled into Don Salvara's office with that silly sigil wallet under your black cloak, destroying his confidence in Lucas Fairwhite, just as a father gently tells his children there's really no such thing as the Blessed Bringer. You're an artist, Master Thorne."
"I've already told you my name is Lucas, Lucas Fairwhite, and..."
"If you tell me that your name is Lucas Fairwhite one more time, I'm going to put a bolt through the back of your upper left arm. I wouldn't mean to kill you just to complicate your life. A nice big hole, maybe a broken bone. Ruin that fine suit of yours, perhaps get blood all over that lovely parchment. Wouldn't the clerks at Maraggio's love to hear an explanation for that? Promissory notes are so much more attention-getting when they're covered in gore."
Locke said nothing for quite a long while.
"Now that won't do either, Locke. Surely you must have realized I can't be one of Barsavi's men."
13, Locke thought. Where the hell did I make a mistake? If the man was speaking truthfully, if he didn't work for Kappa Barsavi, there was only one other possibility. The real spider. The real Midnighters. Had Locke's use of the pretend sigil wallet been reported? Had that counterfeiter in Talisham decided to try for a bit of extra profit by dropping a word with the Duke's secret constables? It seemed the likeliest explanation.
"Turn around. Slowly."
Locke stood up and did so, and bit his tongue to avoid crying out in surprise. The man seated at the table before him could have been anywhere between 30 and 50. He was lean and rangy and grey at the temples. The mark of Camor was upon his face. He bore the sun-darkened olive skin, the high temples and cheekbones, the sharp nose. He wore a grey leather doublet over a grey silk tunic. His cloak and mantle were grey, as was the hood that was swept back behind his head. His hands, folded neatly before him, were covered with thin grey swordsman's gloves, kid leather that was weathered and creased with use. The man had hunter's eyes, cold and steady and measuring. The orange light of the lantern was reflected in their dark pupils. For a second it seemed to Locke that he was seeing not a reflection but a revelation, that the dark fire burned behind the man's eyes. Locke shivered despite himself. All that grey.
"You,"
he whispered, dropping the accent of Lucas Fairwhite.
"None other," said the Grey King. "I disdain these clothes as something of a theatrical touch, but it's a necessary one. Of all the men in Camor, surely you understand these things, Master Thorne."
"I have no idea why you keep calling me that," said Locke, shifting his footing as unobtrusively as he could, feeling the comforting weight of his second stiletto in the other sleeve of his coat. "And I don't see this crossbow you mentioned."
"I said it was at your back."
The Grey King gestured at the far wall with a thin, bemused smile. Warily, Locke turned his head. There was a man standing against the wall of the tavern, standing right in the spot Locke had been staring at until the previous moment. A cloaked and hooded man, broad-shouldered, leaning lazily against the wall with a loaded alley-piece in the crook of his arm, the quarrel pointed casually at Locke's chest.
"I..."
Locke turned back,
But the Grey King was no longer seated at the table. He was standing a dozen feet away, to Locke's left, behind the disused bar. The lantern on the table hadn't moved, and Locke could see that the man was grinning.
"This isn't possible!"
"Of course it is, Master Thorn. Think it through. The number of possibilities is actually vanishingly small."
The Grey King waved his left hand in an arc, as though wiping a window. Locke glanced back at the wall and saw that the crossbowman had disappeared once again.
"Well, fuck me," said Locke. "You're a bondsmage."
"No," said the Grey King. "I'm a man without that advantage, no different than yourself, but I employ a bondsmage."
He pointed to the table where he'd previously been sitting. There, without any sudden movement or jump in Locke's perception, sat a slender man, surely not yet out of his 20s. His chin and cheeks were peach-fuzzed, and his hairline was already in rapid retreat to the back of his head. His eyes were alight with amusement, and Locke immediately saw in him the sort of casual presumption of authority that most congenital blue bloods wore like a second skin. He was dressed in an extremely well-tailored grey coat with flaring red silk cuffs. The bare skin of his left wrist bore three tattooed black lines. On his right hand was a heavy leather gauntlet, and perched atop this, staring at Locke as though he were nothing more than a field mouse with delusions of grandeur, was the fiercest hunting hawk Locke had ever seen. The bird of prey stared directly at him, its eyes pinpoints of black within gold on either side of a curved beak that looked dagger-sharp. Its brown and grey wings were folded back sleekly, and its talons... what was wrong with its talons? Its rear claws were huge, distended, oddly lengthened.
"My associate, the Falconer," said the Grey King, "a bondsmage of Carthane, my bondsmage, the key to a great many things. And now that we've been introduced, let us speak of what I expect you to do for me."
4. "They are not to be fucked with," Chains had told him once, many years before.
"Why not?"
Locke was 12 or 13 at the time, about as cocksure as he'd ever been in life, which was saying something.
"I see you've been neglecting your history again. I'll assign you more reading shortly."
Chains sighed.
"The Bonds Magi of Carthane are the only sorcerers on the continent because they permit no one else to study their art. Outsiders they find must join them or be slain."
"And none resist? Nobody fights back or hides from them?"
"Of course they do, here and there. But what can 2 or 5 or 10 sorcerers in hiding do against 400 with a city-state at their command? What the Bonds Magi do to outsiders and renegades, they make Kappa Barsavi look like a priest of Perelandro. They are utterly jealous, utterly ruthless, and utterly without competition. They have achieved their desired monopoly. No one will shelter sorcerers against the will of the Bonds Magi. No one. Not even the King of the Seven Marrows."
"Curious," said Locke, "that they would still call themselves Bonds Magi, then."
"It's false modesty. I think it amuses them. They set such ridiculous prices for their services, it's less like mercenary work to them and more like a cruel joke at the expense of their clients."
"Ridiculous prices?"
"A novice would cost you 500 crowns a day. A more experienced spellbinder might cost you 1,000. They mark their rank with tattoos around their wrists. The more black circles you see, the more polite you become."
1,000 crowns a day?
"You see now why they're not everywhere, on retainer to every court and noble and pissant warlord with a treasury to waste. Even in times of war and other extreme crises, they can be secured for a very limited duration. When you do cross paths with one, you can be sure that the client is paying them for serious, active work.
Where did they come from?
Carthane.
Ha ha! I mean their guild, their monopoly.
That's easy. One night, a powerful sorcerer knocks on the door of a less powerful sorcerer. I'm starting an exclusive guild, he says. Join me now, or I'll blast you out of your fucking boots right where you stand. So naturally, the second mage says,
you know, I've always wanted to join a guild.
Right. Those two go bother a third sorcerer. Join the guild, they say, or fight both of us, two on one, right here and right now. Repeat as necessary until 300 or 400 guild members are knocking on the door of the last independent mage around, and everyone who said no is dead.
They must have weaknesses, said Locke.
Of course they've got weaknesses, boy. They're mortal men and women, same as us. They eat, they shit, they age, they die. But they're like God's damned hornets. Mess with one and the rest show up to punch you full of holes. 13 help anyone who kills a bondsmage, purposely or otherwise.
Why?
It's the oldest rule of their guild. A rule without exceptions. Kill a bondsmage and the whole guild drops whatever it's doing to come after you. They seek you out by any means they need to use. They kill your friends, your family, your associates. They burn your home. They destroy everything you've ever built. Before they finally let you die, they make sure you know that your line has been wiped from the earth, root and branch.
So nobody's allowed to oppose them at all?
Oh, you can oppose them all right. You can try to fight back, for what it's worth when one of them is against you. But if you go as far as killing one, well, it's just not worth it. Suicide would be preferable. At least then they won't kill everyone you ever loved or befriended.
Wow.
Yes. Chains shook his head. Sorcery's impressive enough, but it's their fucking attitude that makes them such a pain. And that's why, when you find yourself face to face with one, you bow and scrape and mind your sirs and madams.
5.
Nice bird, arsehole, said Locke.
The bondsmage stared coldly at him, nonplussed.
So you must be the reason nobody can find your boss, the reason none of the full crowns could remember what they were doing when tall Tesso got nailed to a wall.
The falcon screeched, and Locke flinched backward. The creature's anger was extremely expressive. It was more than the cry of an agitated animal. It was somehow personal. Locke raised his eyebrows.
My familiar mislikes your tone of voice, said the falconer. I, for one, have always found her judgment to be impeccable. I would mind your tongue.
Your boss expects me to do something for him, said Locke, which means I have to remain functional. Which means the manner in which I address his fucking Carthani lackeys is immaterial. Some of the garistas you killed were friends of mine. I'm looking at an arranged fucking marriage because of you, so eat hemp and shit rope, bondsmage.
The falcon exploded, screeching, from its perch on its master's hand. Locke raised his left arm in front of his face, and the bird slammed against it, talons clutching with edges that sliced through the fabric of Locke's coat sleeve. The bird fastened itself on Locke's arm excruciatingly, and beat its wings to steady itself. Locke hollered and raised his right hand to punch the bird.
"Do that," said the falconer, "and die. Look closely at my familiar's talons."
Biting the insides of his cheeks against the pain, Locke did just that. The creature's rear talons weren't talons at all, but more like smooth, curved hooks that narrowed to needle points at their tips. There were strange, pulsating sacs on the legs just above them, and even to Locke's limited knowledge of hunting birds, this seemed very wrong.
"Vestris," said the Grey King, "is a scorpion hawk, a hybrid, facilitated by alchemy and sorcery. One of many that the Bonds Magi amuse themselves with. She carries not just talons, but a sting. If she were to cease being tolerant of you, you might make it 10 steps before you fell dead in your tracks."
Blood began to drip from Locke's arm. He groaned. The bird snapped at him with its beak, clearly enjoying itself.
"Now," said the Grey King, "are we not all grown men and birds here? Functional is such a relative state of affairs, Locke. I would hate to have to give you another demonstration of just how relative."
"I apologize," said Locke between gritted teeth. "Vestris is a fine and persuasive little bird."
The falconer said nothing, but Vestris released her grip on Locke's left arm, unleashing new spikes of pain. Locke clutched his bloodied wool sleeve, massaging the wounds within it. Vestris fluttered back to her perch on her master's glove and resumed staring at Locke.
"Isn't it just as I said, falconer?"
The Grey King beamed at Locke.
"Our thorn knows how to recover his equilibrium. 2 minutes ago he was too scared to think. Now he's already insulting us and no doubt scheming for a way out of this situation."
"I don't understand," said Locke, "why you keep calling me Thorn."
"Of course you do," said the Grey King. "I'm only going to go over this once, Locke. I know about your little burrow beneath the House of Perelandro, your vault, your fortune. I know you don't spend any of your nights sneak-thieving, as you claim to all the other right people. I know you breach the secret peace to spring elaborate confidence schemes on nobles who don't know any better, and I know you're good at it. I know you didn't start these ridiculous rumors about the Thorn of Camor, but you and I both know they refer to your exploits indirectly. Lastly, I understand that Kappa Barsavi would do some very interesting things to you and all of your gentlemen bastards if the things I know were to be confided to him."
"Oh, please," said Locke. "You're not exactly in any position to whisper politely in his ear and be taken seriously."
"I'm not the one who would be whispering in his ear," said the Grey King, smiling. "If you failed at the task I have for you, I have others close to him to speak for me. I trust I have made myself very clear."
Locke glared for a few seconds, then sat down with a sigh, turning his chair around and leaning his injured arm against the back.
"I see your point. And in exchange?"
"In exchange for the task I require, I would promise you that Kappa Barsavi won't hear about your very cleverly arranged double life, nor that of your closest companions."
"So," said Locke slowly, "that's how it is.
My bondsmage accepted, I'm a thrifty man, Locke."
The Grey King stepped out from behind the bar and folded his arms.
"You get paid in life, not coin."
"What's the task?"
"A straightforward beguilement," said the Grey King. "I want you to become me."
I don't understand."
"The time has come for me to quit this game of shadows. Barsavi and I need to speak face to face. I will very shortly arrange a clandestine conference with the Kappa, one that will bring him forth from the floating grave."
"Fat chance,"